Sounds True presents Near-Death Experiences with Dr. Raymond Moody and Dr. Melvin Morse. Dr. Raymond Moody is the best-selling author of the groundbreaking books Life After Life and The Light Beyond. On this recording, he is joined by pediatrician Melvin Morse, author of the book The Near-Death Experiences of Children. In their work, Dr. Moody and Dr. Morse describe the most common characteristics of the NDE, or near-death experience. Not all people report the same events when describing a near-death experience, yet there are common threads. It is notable that many near-death experiences are accompanied by an initial sensation of profound quiet and peace. Often the individual will hear themselves pronounced dead. There may be a buzzing or ringing sound and an out-of-body experience. The person often enters a dark tunnel and meets with an incredible being who is composed of intense, shimmering light. This is followed by a panoramic review of one's life on Earth and the realization that it is not yet time to die. On this recording, Moody and Morse move beyond discussing the components of the near-death experience to look at its meaning and implications. And now, recorded live, Near-Death Experiences, with Dr. Melvin Morse introducing Dr. Raymond Moody.
Well, it's such a pleasure to be able to introduce Raymond Moody, who's the father of near-death studies. Near-death experiences have been known about throughout history. There have been many, many people that have collected stories of near-death experiences throughout time. And yet the whole term, a near-death experience, did not come into our vocabulary until after Raymond wrote his book, Life After Life. And I've thought a lot about that. And I think it's because his book was so simple and so from the heart, and yet he was the first person to really systematically look at these experiences in a thoughtful way. Raymond Moody was the first person to systematically look at these experiences and to draw some common themes and to see that they are not just simply people reporting hallucinations or reporting visions of another world, but that they're actually experiences which are remarkably similar in many, many ways. I'm going to let, you know, of course, Raymond will go into that in more detail. I do have to tell you all about the first time I ever met Raymond, though. I'm a pediatrician in Seattle, and I actually live in a rural area. And one day, Raymond Moody just called me up on the phone, and I had never met him before. I knew nothing of him. And he told me that he was at the airport and that he wanted to just visit with me for a little while. And of course, my wife and I were just astonished at this. And we had heard so much about him, and he's written all these books, and he's always on television and everything. So I drove out to pick him up at his hotel, which was the seediest, most run-down hotel on the airport strip. And he was dressed just so casually that I took him home, and you know, we chatted for a while. But that night, he spent the night and a couple of days with us, and my wife and I were just, do you really think he's Raymond Moody? and we went and we got his book, and we made sure that his picture matched him, because we were just so puzzled by him, that he was so down to earth and he was just so genuine and honest. And we had sort of expected this the near-death guru to you know, we sort of thought he would be floating on air or something with his own, you know, moonbeams all around him. So that was my introduction to Raymond Moody, and here he is.
Thank you. Carol said tonight that we were just to assume that that she said that almost all of you would have read our works, and so that what you might prefer tonight is to hear about what we're doing right now. And I have been working on a little something different, a new line that I thought maybe we could talk about, since I have all of you here. Have you ever heard of Amway products? No, just teasing, just teasing. Just a little joke. Well, what I'm interested in is consciousness. And, you know, when I think back to my childhood, one of my very earliest memories is sitting in my grandmother's lap in her rocking chair on the front porch in Porterdale, Georgia, when I was about 3 years old. And just it occurring to me that night, you know, like, what in the world is this thing that I'm in, this world or whatever it is? And the mere fact that I was conscious was so astounding to me. I was not really raised a particularly religious person. My dad is a surgeon, and he is not religious at all. And Mom and Dad were nominally Presbyterians when I was a kid, but they didn't really go to church very often. And I didn't go to church, you know, with any sort of regularity. And so really, I grew up assuming that death was just an elimination of consciousness. I never remembered thinking anything but that when you die, it was like the lights go out and that you go into an impenetrable blackness, and that it was like turning off your consciousness, which was very threatening to me because I really do enjoy thinking so much. I am a thinking and information junkie to a very severe degree. In the spring of 1965, I was studying philosophy as an undergraduate at the University of Virginia. And one of my professors, whose name was John Marshall, mentioned to the class that night that there was a psychiatrist in town who was a professor at the medical school, whose name was Dr. George Ritchie. And that Dr. Ritchie had some years before had an experience where he was pronounced dead. Actually, for about a total of about 9 minutes, he was believed dead. The death certificate was written once, and then 9 minutes later, the ward boy, who was unable to accept that a person his own age would die, tried to persuade the doctor to come back and check again just to make sure. And the doctor then came back and pronounced George dead a second time. But then a rather amazing event, George was resuscitated and had this experience. And so since I'm curious about everything about the human mind, I took this opportunity to go listen to that man. And it was quite amazing. He was talking with a group of students that night. And I listened to what he had to say, and first of all, it was very plain that this man was very honest and that he was sincerely reporting what he believed to have happened to him. I never had any doubt whatsoever that Dr. Ritchie was in fact convinced of the reality of what happened to him, and that he had some sort of amazing experience. But you know, when you hear just one thing like that that's so contrary to what you believe as a general rule about life, you don't really know what to make of it. So I just thought of that, and I assumed that he had some form of hallucination, although in 1965 I really wasn't aware of what hallucinations were, but I just assumed this was something physiological. And then about 4 years later, after I had gotten my PhD in philosophy, I was teaching philosophy at East Carolina University. And one day after my lecture, one of the students came up and said, "This is one of those events that's kind of burned in your memory, and I remember it so plainly, I can tell you exactly what he said." He came up and he said, "Dr. Moody, I wish we could talk about life after death in this class." And I said, "Well, why would you want to talk about that?" Because I thought that was rather a quaint thing. I mean, since I didn't believe in it, I thought it was just some kind of superstition. And he said, and again, I can quote him exactly. He said, because about a year ago I was in a bad accident and my doctor said I died. And I had an experience that has totally changed my life, but I haven't had anybody to talk about it with. So what would you say at that point? And I invited him into my office. And I sat there for the next hour at least, probably quite a bit longer than that, listening to this young man, and it was, what he was telling me was identical to what I had heard from Dr. Ritchie 4 years before. I must say that was a rather shaking event to me, because I knew plainly that if I had, if just by coincidence I had come across two reports like these, just coincidentally without engaging in a systematic search at all, that there had to be more. And so then I decided later to go to medical school, but the reason why I decided to go to medical school had nothing to do with this near-death thing. That was not why I chose. I had been kind of young when I got my PhD. I was 24 years old, and so I decided that I needed something practical. So I went on to medical school and wanted to pursue my education. And so I started going around to the resuscitations. And every time I heard of a resuscitation in one of our hospitals, I would go afterward after the patient had revived, and I would sit with them and I would sit down and I would say, not when you died did you go through a tunnel and see a light, you know, not then. I would just say, you know, I understand that you've been really close to death, and I would just like to talk with you about your feelings and, you know, what might have gone on with you during that time. I was very non-committal. But it became very plain to me very quickly that quite a few patients who had been on the verge of death did have something like this happen to them, and that it made a very, very real impact on their lives. Now, I should say something, another thing at the very beginning of this that I think is very, very important, and that's that I think all of us have to realize that these experiences don't give us scientific evidence that we live after we die. I think that's a very important point, because these experiences just can't be construed, I think, as scientific evidence. And there are many reasons for this, and I think that the reasons are just as derived just as much from limitations of the scientific method as they do from limitations of these experiences. Also, I should say at the beginning that I can't claim, therefore, that I am objective about these things, because I have now talked with over 2,500 people who have had these experiences when they are on the brink of death. Personally, I am convinced, I have no doubt whatsoever in my heart that these folks do get a glimpse of the beyond. But what I would also say is that since this is not a scientific judgment or an inference, but rather is a subjective response to these experiences, I have no interest in trying to persuade anybody else of that. But what I thought I would do is that I would give you a little overview of the research on near-death experiences that's going on now all over the world. In fact, what we found now is that it's beginning to appear more and more that we're dealing here with a phenomenon that does seem to transcend cultural bounds to a large degree. I went a little while back over to Europe, and in Norway, in Sweden, in Denmark, in Holland, in France, Germany, in Italy, and more recently in Spain, everywhere I went, I found physicians who have observed these same things among their patients. I should have added Great Britain as well. And we do seem to be finding that the experiences are identically the same, whatever the culture or whatever the national background of these patients. Dr. Göran Grip in Sweden has interviewed over 100 Swedish patients who have had these experiences, again finding they're the same with our as we see in American emergency rooms. Also, incidentally, I've gotten communications now from physicians behind the Iron Curtain as the well, that's to use an anachronism now, I suppose, but physicians from Eastern Europe and the Soviet Union who are finding these identical experiences among their patients. It's a little more baffling in some ways, I think, to the Soviet doctors because it's contrary to their ideology or to the ideology in which they were schooled that these things should be. And yet, you know, they're finding these experiences in Soviet patients as well. A very remarkable bit of research has been done over the past 10 years or so by Dr. George Gallup, who got very interested in these experiences back in the early 80s, and he published a book on it, the title of which I forget. But he devoted the entire resources of the Gallup poll to trying to figure out how many American adults might have had something like this happen to them. And he did a most remarkable study, and he says in his writing on this subject that on the one hand, he is quite amazed by his results, but nonetheless, he's highly confident of them, because what they found was that over 8 million American adults have been through some experience like this. Now, I know that this is a highly selected audience, but just to illustrate a point, I want to ask you, how many of you here know someone personally who has had such an experience? So if you look around the room, you'll see that there are quite a few. And I can also tell you from long experience that's not just a product of the selection of this audience, because even in groups that I've gone to where it wasn't known that I was going to be there, like conventions and so on, and they weren't even anything to do with unusual states of consciousness, you get very much the same kind of result, that these are very, very common kinds of experiences. One of the more remarkable bits of recent research that I have found is the work that's been done by a colleague of ours, Dr. Bruce Grayson. And Bruce is the chairman of the psychiatry department, or was until recently the chairman of the psychiatry department, at the University of Connecticut Medical Center in Hartford. And Bruce, by inclination and training, is an emergency psychiatrist. And so every day in the course of his practice, typically, he gets to see a number of patients who, over the previous few days, have attempted to kill themselves. And since 1976, he's been doing an absolutely remarkable study of the near-death experiences of suicide attempters. He systematically interviewed all the patients who were admitted to his hospitals with a suicide attempt and who recovered, but who had been very close to death because of their suicide attempt. And then he divided these patients into two groups. Obviously, some did and some did not have a near-death experience in connection with their suicide attempt. He followed these two groups of patients over a period of years and continues to follow up on this. And he's found something most remarkable. And that's that while the patients who did not have a near-death experience in connection with their suicide attempt continue as a group to have a high rate of subsequent suicide attempts, the patients who did have a near-death experience in connection with the attempt have an essentially zero rate of any further attempt at self-destruction. And when you ask them about this, when you ask them why, it's very interesting what they say. They don't say it was because that they felt on the basis of this that they would be cast into some terrible hell or something if they had succeeded, but rather they say that it makes life a lot more meaningful to them and is an interesting experience. They come to see that life has a purpose, that they're here to learn something, and that although they're perfectly persuaded because of their experience that at death we pass into another dimension of consciousness, that what they learn from it is somehow that you can't get out of your problems by attempting suicide. I am seeing all the time in psychiatry, when I practiced, that one of the more common forms of neurotic symptoms is the attempt at the geographical cure. And I also will say that I'm an expert practitioner of this myself, that when things get, you know, bad in one place, I decide, well, I'll just move on to some other location. But the difficulty with that is that the same problem that you run away from is sort of meets you at the door in the new place. The folks who have been almost dead as a result of their suicide attempts tell us the same thing, that they find that you can't really get away from whatever you're trying to get away from in that way, that you've got to confront these problems and eventually get through them. Well, something that Bruce Grayson's work implies is very, very fascinating to me. And one hears a lot, first of all, that patients who have near-death experiences come back transformed in very dramatic ways. And this is undeniably true in my judgment. I have now been looking into this phenomenon for a period of about, say, 25 years. It's very plain to me that these people undergo tremendous changes in their lives, very, very dramatic changes. By and large, what they tell us is that they lose their fear of death, that although they're not seeking death, they wouldn't go out and try to kill themselves to get back into this blissful realm, that nonetheless that death itself holds no terror for them. In one way, it's easy to look at that and say, well, sure, after something like this for a couple of weeks, you might say something like that. But really, when it got right down to it and the person was faced again with death, he would have the same reaction as we imagine anybody else would, one of fear and anguish and this kind of thing. But I can again say from personal experience now over a long period of time that this is just not so. Patients who have had near-death experiences do face death with remarkable equanimity. Obviously, having known so many of these people now over so many years, quite a few of them, people that I first knew because I learned about their near-death experience and I talked with them about it, and then I became friendly with them and followed them for years, sometimes decades, but then they would go on to pass into their final illness, and I was with some of these people, as a matter of fact, as they died. I've been with a number of people now, as they died, who I had first known because they had near-death experiences. And I can assure you that they meet death with this complete sense of serenity, very, very inspiring to others around them. Well, one thing that is often said is that these changes that we see in these people who've confronted death and have been, in many cases, pronounced dead and resuscitated, that really this is not a feature of the near-death experience. It's something that would happen to anybody who came close to death, regardless of whether they had an experience or not. Some people want to think that it's the mere shock that of the fact that they almost died, that they came so close, that brings about these tremendous life changes. But I think Bruce's work shows very clearly that this is not the case. The measurable effect pertains only to those people who do have a near-death experience. So there does seem to be some transformative power in these experiences themselves. And I thought that what I would talk about tonight is exactly that. A feature of the near-death experience that I'm particularly interested in is how it has these effects on people. Like, what brings that about? What brings about this powerful change? What component or components of the near-death experience is it that accounts for this? Well, I'm beginning to believe that it has two features. Number one, this encounter with a light that these people describe seems to be very, very powerful in itself. We say light, but it's so interesting that the very articulate patients who go through this will tell us something very, very interesting. I remember the first person I heard it from, that it really just set me afire with the way he said it for the first time in a very dramatic way. And that was a friend of mine, actually, a friend named Jim. And Jim had gone to medical school with me. As a matter of fact, he and I went all the way through medical school together, and we knew each other quite well during medical school. We were in the same social group, more or less. I thought I knew Jim very well, and I really thought I assumed he trusted me, and that, you know, we were fairly close. And also Jim knew that I was working on near-death experiences. He knew that from the very earliest time in medical school that I was interested in this subject and that I was sympathetic to it. And yet all the way through medical school and then into our residency, we both went to the same residency program in psychiatry. Sometime into our first year of residency, Jim took me aside one day and he said, "Raymond, I want you to come into my office for a minute. I want to tell you something." And so he sat down and he told me about his own very dramatic near-death experience some years before. Well, the reason I tell you that is to make you aware that these experiences are very, very personal, and that although Jim, I think, was a good friend of mine, it took him 5 years into our acquaintanceship before he could really open up to me. A person that he already knew was very sympathetic about this. But Jim told me this. He said, when he was talking about his encounter after he got through this tunnel into this brilliant light, and he said that it was a warm, soft, loving light. And he said, "I said light, but I could just as easily say love." So this powerful experience people have of going into a sense of love and peace that's so totally overwhelming and pervasive is a very, very profoundly and touching experience for people. But also I think that the transformations that we see come about from this review of their lives that the people go through. And this is one thing I suppose that I think in the way this is generally looked at and the way you hear about it, I don't think that the sense of it can be conveyed very well by the descriptions that we have, unless you really sit and talk with these patients who've been through this, and you see what an amazing experience it is. When I first started listening to this many years ago, I assumed that they were talking about like a movie of their lives, like you would with the frames in order, everything is in the correct temporal sequence, but it would be like you would put a film into a projector and speed it up and make it go through the projector at super speed. But then I came to realize as I talked with more and more people that it's not like that at all, really, that in some way that we find very difficult to put into words, as a matter of fact that you can't put into words, everything they've ever done is there at once in a kind of panorama, which they see, incidentally, in full color and in three dimensions and from a third-person perspective. And by that I mean that when they go through these events, apparently they're not seeing the events of their lives replayed from the point of view of the person they were and seeing these things from behind their eyes, but rather their perspective is displaced, like they would be watching a third person. In other words, if I were having one of these experiences right now, for instance, I apparently wouldn't be reliving this event from the perspective of standing up here behind the podium looking at it through my spectacles. I would be watching myself from out there. My perspective would be displaced to the side. And I would be witnessing this event from that perspective, but not only that, apparently I would also be monitoring the effects that I was having on other people. So that if I will, so what people say, for instance, is that if you see yourself doing a loving action to someone that you were involved with in your life, then when that action results, you become that other person in some way, and you feel directly the good feelings that you've brought about in the life of that person. But on the other hand, if you see yourself doing something unloving to someone, then when that action results, you get to feel the anguish and the sadness you've brought about in another person's life, which makes me feel that I'm not looking forward at all to seeing this myself. And yet, you know, what people will say is that the experience as a whole is a plus for them because they learn about themselves in such a dramatic way. I have a fellow I've known for many years who is very touchy about his near-death experience. In many ways, I'm one of the few people that he's ever told about it. And he is a fundamentalist minister in Georgia. And it's so interesting because he had his near-death experience some years before, and he is still a fundamentalist minister. He still is in the same church that he was when he had his experience. And the reason he tells me this is, he uses this phrase, grow where you were planted. And what he says is that he tries to bring this into the church that he grew up in. And his near-death experience happened many years ago when he was in his last year of seminary training. And in his particular church, they have to, the ministerial students in their last couple of years of training have to serve a church in the country. And in Georgia, you know, there's a lot of rural areas still. They would have to go out on Sundays and serve some church that would not normally be able to have a minister. And he said on this one Sunday, he was driving along, going to this church, and he had a terrible accident. It's really, truly a miracle. I've seen the pictures of this wreck. There's really no accounting for how this guy is alive. But nonetheless, and as a matter of fact, a doctor who was passing by on the road stopped and just said he's dead, and said he was dead at that time. The rescue squad members thought he was dead, and nonetheless took him to the hospital. And he said, as many of these patients have described, he said on the way into the hospital, he was hovering outside of the ambulance, and he was just following the ambulance along, wondering what the fate of that body and there was going to be, whether he would live or not. But he got into the hospital, and for various reasons, which I'm sure many of you that might be in the medical community know, that sometimes you do nonetheless attempt resuscitations for various reasons. And in his case, he did revive, and he had this, in the interim, he had this experience, the whole thing of going through this tunnel into the light and seeing this review of his life replayed in the presence of a tremendously powerful and loving being that he identified as Christ. Now, I have talked with so long and so many times with this man, and there's many, many endless hours of conversation we've had. And he has told me so much about this review of his life. But there's one little scene that comes back into my mind that's so telling. And he was describing how there was one scene he was describing to me where he said he was watching himself deliver one of his typical Sunday sermons. And he was the type of person who, it was mostly, you know, how you're going to hell if you drink and if you smoke and all these other things. So he said this time, though, when he saw this sermon, he could see himself up in the podium, or whatever they call it in the church. But he was watching himself from a distance, and then he said he was kind of going through the audience. He was kind of monitoring how he looked and all these different people. And he said suddenly he found himself looking at this from the point of view of this 9-year-old boy who was in the congregation. And he said that the particular little boy was a little boy that he knew, but there was not a personal relationship there. It's just that he knew the kid's name, and he knew the parents of the child, but it was not one of the couples in the church that he was particularly related to. It was just, you know, just, and he said he still doesn't know why he picked up this particular one. But he said that as he went through this, that he was there sitting with this little boy, and he felt the stark terror that he was bringing about into the life of this child. And he said at this point, this being who was there with him, watching this review, said, and people will say that it's not like hearing a physical voice, it's that you're immediately aware of the thoughts that are being passed back and forth. But he said the thought was, not in words, but he had to translate it into words to tell it to me. But he said, the thought was, in no way in condemnation, it wasn't even like a criticism. It was in no way harsh, but it was just very matter-of-factly that the thought came, I suspect you won't be saying things like that anymore, will you? And so, what he told me at this point, and he said, these are his exact words, he said, I was very surprised to learn that God was not interested in my theology. That what he was interested in was the loving relationships with how he had learned to love in this, these scenes that were there before him. Is it time? Well, we can talk about this all later, and now I have the pleasure of introducing my friend Melvin. What can I say about Melvin except it's so much fun to have him as a friend, because on the one hand I can talk about medical things with him, and on the other hand it's just like having another little kid to play with. He's really a truly delightful person. And I first heard about Melvin's work back in about 1984 or 1985. And one of my colleagues, Bruce Grayson, said that, did you know that there's been a wonderful article in the American Journal of the Diseases of Children on the near-death experiences of kids? I found out that Melvin had published not just one, but then over the next couple of years, a series of three articles in one of the most conservative and reputable publications in pediatrics in the world, the American Journal of the Diseases of Children, on his fascinating work with the near-death experiences of kids. And so I am just so happy to introduce you to my wonderful friend Melvin Morse, who to me is just like a teddy bear. He's very... I do want to tell you one thing about him. It's like, he told me when I first met him, he said, well, you know, the reason he went into medicine was I just love to talk to people. And that was how he heard about the first story that he ever heard of, was that he had a patient, 7 years old, I believe, who had almost drowned. And Melvin went back and sat with that child, and he said he had never had a patient who had come so close to death and drowning, and he just wanted to know what this child thought. So he sat down with her and he listened, and now he's been listening ever since to some really fascinating stories. So, Melvin.
Are these experiences real? A five-year-old girl asked me that question. She's a child that my partner and I resuscitated from nearly dying of bacterial meningitis. And she had a cardiac arrest, her heart had stopped beating, and she had to be resuscitated. I'd like to digress a little bit, because I know you guys see on TV, and I know some people in the audience here are physicians, so this won't come as a surprise to them, but I know you see on TV where they're having a cardiac arrest, and they're calling for the nurses, and they're restarting their heart, and then the person is awake again. To survive a cardiac arrest is 1 in 1,000. even an in-house cardiac arrest. So when I tell you that this is a child whose heart stopped beating and then was resuscitated, her chance, given today's medical technology, for her to have a full recovery is extraordinary. You know, 1 in 100, 1 in 1,000. These are true life flatliners. These are people who have truly been to the brink of death and have been resuscitated. And this little girl said to me just what I just asked you. She said to me, but are these experiences real? Did it really happen to me, Dr. Morse? That's what she said. She said that during her resuscitation, she was floating out of her body. She could see my partner and I working to revive her. She accurately described everything that was going on. She drew me a picture in which she drew our little crash cart, and she had all the little details right, etc. Well, I know that perhaps she in some unconscious way assimilated this material, etc. And she herself didn't know if this really happened to her, because then she said that she went to heaven and that she met Jesus. Well, I said to her, what was Jesus like? Oh, he was nice. That's, you know, the way a child is. And then she drew me a picture of Jesus. And I wish I had a slide projector here to show you, but this was a Jesus that looked like Santa Claus with a jolly red hat and a round face and a round body and arms and legs. And she furthermore said there was dead people in heaven waiting to be reborn. And she also said there was a rainbow there that was really beautiful. Now, her question to me comes to the heart of the near-death experience. She herself wondered whether this was some sort of hallucination, something induced perhaps by the high fever. When she presented to the emergency room, she had a temperature of 105 degrees. Or perhaps drugs. And she herself said to me, I didn't think you could talk to Jesus. So that, you know, when you think about these experiences, before I'd actually talked with people who'd had them, when I just kind of had heard about them, or, you know, read Raymond's book, or saw the headlines in the National Enquirer, dramatic new proof of life after death, I had always assumed that these were experiences which were culturally conditioned. A five-year-old child, after all, is told that when you die, you're going to go to heaven. Here she is, confronted with a life-threatening disease. Even though she may not have been told she was going to die, she certainly must have gotten the idea. Her parents are crying, doctors are rushing in, or, you know, all kinds of things are happening to her. And yet she was troubled because she had never been taught in Sunday school that you could actually talk to Jesus. And furthermore, she was deeply troubled by these dead people in heaven, because she thought that when you died, you went to heaven, and that heaven was not some kind of a resting place that people could, come back from. In fact, her vision, or her experience, or her near-death experience, implied reincarnation to her, which was very troubling to this five-year-old mind, because that is not what she had taught. So right away, this child, to me, speaks to this issue. Clearly, her experience was not culturally conditioned, because it conflicted in some really important ways from her own religious training. Well, is it reasonable to think that these experiences could be confabulations? Could they be made up? After all, Dr. Moody's work, he has detailed hundreds and hundreds of patients who have had the same experience. Japan, India, throughout the world. They've even done studies in Micronesia in which people have described near-death experiences. And yet, I'm going to tell you another experience, one that maybe you all have read about. I read in the paper, in the Seattle Times, that when the circus came to town, there was a parade of elephants. And one of the elephants had been trained to sit on a red ball. And as this parade of elephants came to the Seattle Coliseum, there was a red Volkswagen parked by the side of the road. And so this elephant sat on that Volkswagen. And then that person came back to discover their car had been crushed. And she got in the car and started and drove home because the engine wasn't damaged. And she was stopped by a policeman. And she was given a ticket and taken to the police station because it was assumed she was drunk because she said, well, an elephant sat on my car. And that's why it's in the terrible condition it is. But that story was reported in the Seattle Times, has been reported in the New York Times, and has been reported in numerous newspapers throughout the country. And yet it has never happened. It's an urban folktale. It's a product of our culture. And a man named Jan Dunwald has collected dozens and dozens of these stories. And maybe you have heard some of them, the hitchhiker story, the babysitter story. They're all reported as being true. Carl Sagan, who could be a bigger brain than him, billions and billions of nerve cells, you know, I mean, he's a really smart guy. He doesn't say this about the near-death experience. Don't let me put words in his mouth. But Carl Sagan says that the UFO phenomena, where all these people are reporting that they've seen UFOs and they've been abducted and taken up to UFOs, etc., Carl Sagan says that that is a cultural myth inspired by science fiction writers. And in fact, there is some evidence that this kind of thing is true. There was a famous battle in World War I in which the Allies took a terrible beating and were decisively defeated and were retreating. And those soldiers, by common tale, state that angels saved them from being decimated. That story was actually written by a writer. And he wrote that about 2 weeks after this battle, in which he suggested in his story that perhaps angels had saved these soldiers. Lo and behold, after he wrote this, there became then numerous reports of soldiers stating they had in fact seen those angels. So it is so simply that many of these stories have been collected, to me, is not adequate proof that these experiences are real.
This concludes Side A.